What show do you do?
It's called Polycast.
On the internet, is it?
Someone suggested that we put together a box set. This person wants Imran and I to sign it, but I thought we went over that we were the same person.
Well, just sign it twice, Dan. They won't know.
Welcome to Polycast, the official podcast of Appleton Civilization site. I'm Daniel Quick, known as Dan Q on the forums, and with me is Mackie.
What? Who? Where? Hi.
And Locutus, as he's known on the forums, but in something called real life, I don't know, Butter Schneiders.
What is this real life thing you speak of?
I didn't mean to scare you, I'm sorry.
Yes, telling scary stories again.
Mommy!
And a first-time guest co-host, because I guess he's crazy. I don't know why he agreed to this, but anyway. Dale, how are you?
I'm good. How is everyone?
Not bad. I guess there's a lot to talk about. I don't know.
Yeah. You think?
Seriously, it's me on the Swordcast now.
It's fair to say that Modcast and Senate.
Yeah.
I think they've been booked.
Big time.
Dale, I think you just better go first and take all the time you want.
Have we got 3 hours?
Holy Romans, Batman. That's a lot of Beyond the Sword news.
Well, a lot of stuff's been released.
Sword Beyond it is.
Thanks, Yoda.
Imparted information, we will try.
It got to be so big because we listen to fan feedback a lot. And, you know, because we have so great fans, we know what the shortcomings were for Civ 4, and we know pretty much thanks to them how to fix it.
If anyone was listening to the CFC chat, then they would have heard that Jesse announced that Road to War was actually my mod for Beyond the Sword. I just wanted to just say a few words, clear up a few things, and drop a few goodies on everyone's desk. Firstly, Hitler. Ooh, the big topic of the day. But unfortunately, Hitler is not in. And for those of you going, ooh, who's in, who's in? Well, you'll just have to wait and see, won't you? I did announce that it was going to be the Vice-Chancellor, but which Vice-Chancellor?
Oh, you tease.
But aside from that, basically what Jesse was explaining as it being the deepest strategical World War II scenario, well, I don't know if it's actually that, but...
Well, I can confirm that, I think.
Thank you. But I've tried to include as much historical depth to be able to immerse the player into the World War II. For instance, in the normal epic game, all you do is with bombing is just one mission. It's just bombing of defences, but I've actually got 3 bombing missions that you can do. You can also blow up factories and civil buildings as well, so you can really hurt the enemy's production. Instead of religions, there's ideologies. There's going to be 3 different scenarios within the mod, 2 of them based in Europe and 1 in the Pacific, actually, but they're all different time frames. I've also expanded the events that the Epic game has through the use of different game modes. There's either going to be historical events, or you can just have complete open play. And under the historical events, it's basically a restricted game mode, whereas you can't declare war or make peace. The actual events occur on the actual dates of the war. And the third game mode is sort of in between, a bit of events, but a bit of randomness as well. So how's that sounding so far?
It not only sounds cool, it plays pretty cool as well. Because I've played it a couple of times. Gotta keep rubbing it in.
Uh-huh, apparently.
It's a lot better than our effort with Desert War, isn't it?
Oh, yes. This is way beyond that. Don't know if you want to tell anything about the map scale.
Now he does.
Yeah, now I do. Well, basically, it's going to be an absolutely huge map that's only going to run on my... Nah, just kidding. All three maps are just a little bit larger than standard continents. It's tried so that more computers can run it, but I've already got plans to release some huge maps after release of VTS. Thank you very much, Dan, but you've given me a spot that I can upload it all.
You're welcome.
So, yes, if you didn't catch that, Apolliton is going to be the official site of Road to War after release.
Woohoo!
What I wanted to say about the map scale, I mean, in my experience, the portion of the map that was covered by the Desert War scenario is almost as large in this scenario, so it's really a huge map. I don't know if you want to reveal approximately how many cities are in Britain or in Germany or something like that, so that people have some kind of idea of how big this thing already is.
Well, just looking at the British Isles, they've got about 13 cities.
13? Wow.
Be about that, yeah.
That's a big Britain.
Last time I played it, I think it was closer to 6, but maybe you changed it, or that's the bigger map, or...
Actually, you're right, it is the bigger map. I've tried to get as much utilization out of the land as possible.
And Germany had something like, I think, 15 cities or something like that. That's pretty awesome for a very small territory.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's certainly the biggest map for a World War II scenario I've ever seen, at least in an official release. There might be fan mods out there that have been bigger. Can you tell us what time periods exactly? You said different starting dates. What are they?
Well, from the heading Road to War, it obviously starts before the war. The two scenarios, one in Europe and one in the Pacific, they start on the 1st of January 1936, and they run right through past the war to 1950. And the third scenario starts in July of 1939, and that's only a European map. So it gets the players in as fast as possible into the war.
It's definitely nice to be able to do your own build-up and start in 1936.
And you can take your nation in so many different ways. You could go for air power or naval power or land power, or if you're playing the open mode, then you can try the diplomacy mode and get as many allies as you can before general war starts. There's just so many different possibilities with this mod.
Yep.
I take it then this mod is atypical in the sense that you actually start before the war starts, that's not common for a World War II scenario. A World War II scenario, typically you're already in the thick of it.
Yes. It definitely starts well before most of the other World War II mods, which either take off at Barbarossa in 1941 against Russia, or they start in 1939, or even from the entrance of USA into the war.
And even in the build-up up to war, there will be war. There's no way that you can avoid conflict. Is that true?
Yeah, definitely. Like in the historical event mode, all the nations that were in the war historically are going to be in the war at some point in time. Even in the open mode, which is where it's completely at the player control who you declare war on or not, you are going to get dragged into it. I've modified the AI a little bit on top of Blake's AI to utilize more of the war techniques that Blake programmed in. Yeah, it declares war willy-nilly now, and just, it will try to crush you.
What nations are in this game? I mean, obviously you mentioned Spain, I assume Britain, Germany, Russia, what other nations, and how many of these can you actually play with?
Okay, well in Europe there's 15 nations, a couple of the smaller ones, or the ones that were absorbed early on in the actual mod, I've skipped over. Like, for instance, there's no Switzerland, there's no Austria, and Czechoslovakia isn't in. But there's also a couple of areas on the map which are combined nations, like, for instance, the Balkans. They're split into East and West Balkans, and like the East is Romania, Bulgaria, whereas the West will be Yugoslavia and Greece. The big six nations, they are definitely separate. They're all playable. You can even play nations like Finland, Norway. Some of the nations that didn't put up any defence when they got declared against, they're not playable just from the point that in gameplay terms, it's pointless playing those nations because you're going to be around for one or two turns when someone declares war on you. And I'm sorry, Wouter, but that also includes the Netherlands.
Yes, I noticed. Well, I don't mind. I have enjoyed playing as the British and sending in a lot of troops to the Netherlands to try and save it. You said Apollaton is going to host Road to War and you're going to release a bigger map. What exactly are the future plans for Road to War?
There's a lot of stuff that I plan to have in Road to War that unfortunately got cut on the editing table for numerous reasons. They will be included back in, including about 200 megs worth of videos made by Apollaton's Hexagonia, and he did a fantastic job with them too. There's also going to be new graphics for a lot of the unique units. There's going to be some new features that just didn't make the cut in time. Like, for instance, during the war, you'll be able to switch with an ally. So you could start off as Poland, and when Germany declares war on you, go, and switch to England.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
But I've also got plans definitely to release a global map, and that's going to be on a huge scale, so I wouldn't recommend it to all you Pentium 3 users out there.
Yeah, I'm not going to be using that. And I have slightly better than a Pentium 3.
And the actual address is in the mod, so as soon as you play it, you'll know to come to Apollaton and what address to go to.
Thank you, Al, for all of those goodies. That was an Apollaton exclusive.
No problem.
Sound effects win everything, not yet.
Alex actually was originally from the fan community, and he was brought onto the team, so he had basically deciphered Civ 3, and we were so impressed with everything that we brought him on to help us with Civ 4, and he pretty much just took over the reins for both of the expansion packs.
Since we were talking about Stereos, there's a write-up on IGN about Fall from Heaven.
Yes, that looks quite interesting as well.
This mod, my goodness, takes a 14-member development team. Woo!
Yes, they definitely had a large team, and I believe most of them were artists.
Yeah, he says himself, 3 writers and 5 artists.
Yes, and indeed mentioning how his team is very fortunate to have so many experienced individuals to be able to devote as much time on this mod as they have, which is more than Firaxis themselves could.
That's the advantage of fan mods. Fans work for free, so you can basically hire as many people as you want.
The scenario the team is having included in the expansion is a prequel to their publicly hosted mod, with some of the differences from the basic Civ experience. More emphasis on individual units, more combat experience, and more powerful promotions. There are large wild lands and limited city sprawl with the majority of the map uninhabitable, and the active climate additions with emphasis on blizzards which damage units, destroy improvements, change terrain, for the worse. And, on the plus side, however, it may open up new areas to explore or new ways for the enemy to get to you as bodies of water freeze over. And when I say on the plus side, I mean new ways for you to get to the enemy, not the enemy to get to you.
It's an interesting scenario. I'm personally not a fan of fantasy, so this is not really for me. But it is a very challenging mod. I tried to play it twice, and I totally got my kicked. So it should be fun.
So he gives us some respect now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I must agree. It does come across as a very good mod. It is very challenging. But like you, Wouter, I'm no fantasy fan, but I'm sure there's thousands of people out there that are going to get an absolute kick out of this as a prequel to their Fall from Heaven games.
I think it's fair to say those who haven't heard of the mod and get the Beyond the Sword expansion will then go online and find the free or public version as well.
I think if you haven't heard of Fall from Heaven, you haven't played Civ 4.
Well, there are plenty of people who only play the offline game, who never go online. So yeah, for them it might open up a whole new world.
A whole new world.
Oh, no singing, no singing.
UA manager Tim McCracken, his scenario Afterworld is a far departure from the normal Civ stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely out there. It's not your typical game of Civ. There aren't any settlers. There's no diplomacy. There's no research. There's no leaders. It's Civ, but Civ like you've never seen it before.
I think one of those latest articles went into scenarios further.
In the game's Radar hand-on preview, they talked a little bit more about the Afterworld scenario.
Oh, yes. And they had some really cool screenshots.
Which we would show you, but this is not a visual medium.
Yeah, that's kind of the problem with the podcast.
So with the Afterworld scenario from the GR article, the direction that you face affects your line of sight, meaning that you'll need to carefully consider each step you take as you proceed through the fog of war, covered wastelands, in search of a mysterious data source. In Next War, which is set in the middle of the 21st century, you control clone armies and mechanized units.
Giant death robot!
Woohoo! From what I could tell, we got the most information on the Final Frontier scenario, just for Mackie. A sci-fi scenario where you must explore and settle star systems while trying to find the way home to Earth. Although the more particular details came from the GameSpy preview, a star map instead of a planetary one. One of the immediate changes noticed is that while solar systems are the heart of your city, you can designate which planets within a system gets which buildings. Galaxy is populated with asteroid fields that can provide defensive and resource bonuses, impassable nebulae, dangerous radiation fields, and ultra-dangerous black holes. Understatement, probably.
Yeah.
Additionally, since there are vast reaches of space between solar systems, the way you spread your borders and culture is via star bases. Not only do star bases establish borders, but they also house military units to defend said borders. GalCiv 2 influence anyone?
I was going to say, it's like someone's crossed GalCiv 2 and Battlestar Galactica.
Military units range from battleships, carriers, fighter bomber squadrons to Delta or even Omega level upgrades for each unit. And finally, since you're already in space, the spaceflight victory conditions has been replaced. Wonder why they would do that. with human ascendancy, which translates into creating dimensional warp gates instead of a space shuttle. Stargate anyone?
Yeah.
Is there lightsabers? Because then we have everything.
There you go.
Right now I'm working on a scenario called Crossroads of the World, and what I really wanted to do is I wanted to feature one of the new things that we're going to be having in Beyond the Sword, and I chose the corporations for that. And so I wanted to try to tweak them a little bit and turn them more into old-style trade guilds.
The feature on IGN beginning.
Yeah, so we found out about all the last Civs. We also find out all the unique units and all the unique buildings and stuff like that. First one is the Babylonians. We knew about that one for a while, with Hammurabi as their leader. He's aggressive and organized. Starts with wheel and agriculture. This unit is a bowman, no surprise there. Replaces an archer and grants an extra 50% versus melee. I guess makes them a decent rush unit.
Ooh, I was about to say. New archer rush option.
Yep. And their unique building is a garden, which replaces the Colosseum and grants an additional health.
And they start with roads right from the first turn, so they're able to get paths out to the enemies fairly quickly.
And then grow their cities faster also because they have agriculture. So that's, yeah, they are going to be quite popular.
The next one is Byzantium. It's led by Justinian I, imperialistic and spiritual, as such with wheel and mysticism. The unique unit is the Cataphract, replaces Knight, and has 2 extra strength, but is not immune to first strikes. That sounds also like a pretty powerful unique unit. And the unique building is the Hippodrome, replaces Theodore, and gives loads of extra happiness, as it's posted here. One base happiness, one more for horses, and one more for every 5% you spend on culture instead of 10%. Well, that's a pretty decent unique building as well.
Especially on a higher level, you'll have a lot less happiness problems.
With the Hippodrome, you're able to hold off on other happiness buildings for a lot longer.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
I think Water might be impartial to the next one.
He might be a little biased.
A little bit. Of course, we're talking about the Dutch, led by Willem van Oranje. It's creative and financial. It starts with fishing and agriculture, as the East India Man as a unique unit, which replaces the galleon, gives +2 strength and an extra cargo space, and can also explore rival territory. And the unique building is the dike, which replaces the levee, a new building, and grants an extra production for every water down. Yeah, that's a pretty strong unique building.
That could be very handy.
Probably together with the Holy Roman building, the strongest unique building in the bunch, I think.
I like the East Indiaman too, because now if you have great merchants or other units like that that you want to take into a rival who you're not necessarily don't have open borders with, you can just ride on in and you can just take not just one at a time, but a whole group at a time.
It's a ship, and a lot of people see that as a downside for a unique unit. This is a pretty neat ship. It's good in combat.
I think the Dutch will be really good on the archipelago or the lot of water maps, but I think on a large land mass like Pangaea or even two or three continents, I think the Dutch will really struggle to make great use of all their unique unit and unique building features.
Well, I think actually on land maps the Dutch will still be a pretty powerful force because they have some very strong traits.
And next is Ethiopia.
Led by Zara Jacob, and it's creative and organized, starts with hunting and mining, as an Oromo warrior as a unique unit which replaces the musket man, and it gives a first level first strike, and is also immune to first strikes, and it begins with drill 1 and drill 2. And the unique building is the Steely, not sure how to pronounce it. It replaces the monument and gives extra 25% culture.
Yes, for those who may not otherwise see the value in building monuments, seeing as their whole obsolescence thing, perhaps this will encourage people, if they play this Civ, to build it some more, because culture is good.
Yeah, it is kind of odd that this is a creative trait, and you get a culture bonus for the monument. Usually you either have creative or you build monuments, so that's kind of odd.
Yeah, you build them early on, even if you don't manage to get Stonehenge, you're going to grab a lot of territory really fast.
Yeah, that's true.
Of course, you're going to be waiting a while for your nice unique unit.
I think one of the important things to note here with Ethiopia is that gunpowder units look to be able to get drill 1 and 2 now.
Yeah, well, is that true for all gunpowder units or just for the Oromo Warrior?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a question yet to be answered, but we'll see.
And since the Holy Roman Empire has been announced, there's been some controversy about its inclusion.
Really? I hadn't noticed.
No, has there?
I'm here to inform. So we have Charlemagne as its leader, imperialistic and protective, starting technologies, mysticism, and hunting. The unique unit is
Lansknecht.
Replaces the pikeman. In addition to its existing mounted bonus, it comes with +100% versus melee units.
Ooh, that's going to be ouchy.
Yeah.
I don't want to attack the city to have those in it.
That is a very strong unique unit.
Yeah, nice.
Mm-hmm. And its unique building is...
a rat house.
The rat house.
Okay, its unique building is the R, and it replaces the courthouse. Lowering maintenance by an additional 25%, and only 4 are needed to build the Forbidden Palace.
The next service was the Khmer, they're led by Surya Varman. And that's creative and expensive. Starting techs, hunting and mining. They have probably the coolest unique unit, the Ballista Elephant. Places the war elephant, of course, and pretty neat little effect as well. And when attacking in stacks outside of city walls, elephants will automatically target mounted unit first. And the unique unit is a barai, which replaces aqueduct and grants an additional food. I don't think it's terribly powerful, but it's a very interesting civ.
I think this one's leaning towards being a settler farmer Civ.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, expensive, extra food, creative. This is definitely something that will allow you to expand fairly quickly. The only problem is with the unique unit, of course. It would have been nice to have an elephant unit that doesn't require elephant resources, but it doesn't say anything about that. You might have trouble actually building this unique unit, because elephants are fairly rare.
And then you also have to get to the point where you can build it. Because if you're trying to expand too much, somebody may come over and try to take over your cities, because if you expand too quickly, of course, which is kind of encourages you to expand quickly.
That's definitely true as well, yeah. The Mayans are next, led by Pakal II, expansive and financial, such as mysticism and mining, as a Holcom as unique units, which places the spearman, is immune to first strike, and doesn't need copper or iron.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful unit as well for the early game. Great rusher. And the unique building is the Ball Court. What else? Replaces Colosseum and grants +2 happiness.
Yeah, that's Spearman. Ooh.
Yeah, that's a pretty awesome unit.
Yeah, immune to first strike in the first place, but then also being built without copper or iron. Finally, something you can use on one of those maps that you don't get either.
Yeah. Spearman comes very, very early. It comes with hunting, I think. So, yeah, you can start building them right away.
And then next we have Native American, which also controversy.
Another popular choice.
Just a little bit.
Imran isn't here.
Yeah, thankfully.
Or we wouldn't be hearing the end of it.
His leader is Sitting Bull. Philosophical and protective traits, starting technologies, fishing, and agriculture. The unique unit is a axeman replacement, the Dog Soldier, that has -1 strength but an additional 50% versus melee units, and even more critically, I believe, also requires no resources to build.
Mm-hmm.
And the unique building is a totem pole, which replaces monument, and all new archery units get +3 experience.
I'm not sure where they get archery experience in totem pole, but okay.
Yeah, that's kind of a stereotype, unfortunately.
But we have yet another really good MP unit. X-Men with no resource.
Yeah, but it does have -1 strength, so a lot of people are unhappy about that.
Yeah, but seeing early on, you're mostly against melee units. It's an additional 50%. I don't know.
That's definitely true. But you are extra vulnerable to chariots.
True.
There is a lot of syncrasy between the protective trait and the bonus you get for your archers because of the unique building. So that's going to be one hell of a pain in the butt to actually attack Native Americans.
And so then we come to the Portuguese. There's an Iaio II, expansive and imperialistic, starting technologies, fishing, and mining. The unique unit is a caravel replacement. The Carac has an additional cargo space, can carry military units. Oh, Mackie and I are happy.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
And can explore rival territory. The unique building is the Fittoria and replaces the custom house. Get one additional commerce from all water tiles.
Whoa.
Well, not that commerce was a problem on water tiles before, but we'll take it.
It's a mini financial trait.
Yeah, basically.
They're actually technically expansive, imperialistic, and financial.
Yeah, you get it.
I mean, only on water, but...
Yeah, this is definitely, again, a very powerful naval ship. On archipelagos and stuff like that, these will really rule the map, together with the Dutch.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, if you're stuck inland, you can pretty much forget about this one. I mean, the Dutch at least have some pretty good traits and a decent, unique building.
And so then, finally, the Sumerian, led by Gilgamesh, creative and protective traits, starting technologies, wheel, and agriculture. The unique unit, another axeman replacement here, the Vulture, has +1 strength, but suffers a 25% reduction against melee units. Unique building is a courthouse replacement, the Ziggurat. 20 hammers cheaper than the courthouse, and only 4 are required to build the Forbidden Palace.
I guess that would be another good one for large empires.
And small empires if you have nothing else to do.
Indian empires.
Yeah.
It's another interesting axe, but I think you'll have to actually see that one in action to see whether that strength is going to offset the reduction against the melee. Of course, it'll be better against chariots.
Yeah, it's just the other way around.
Not really impressed by this one. It's pretty meh, M-E-H.
Yeah.
Meh.
The late game starts or advanced starts, the way that they work is that the player gets a certain number of points that they start with, and they launch into the game. It's almost like you're building a scenario. You're spending points. So you get a certain number of points depending upon your difficulty level or what area you're starting in. And that allows you to kind of build this mini empire that you can start with.
New leaders.
America, we have Lincoln, charismatic and philosophical. Celtic, Boudica, aggressive and charismatic. The French one, De Gaulle, Charles De Gaulle, charismatic and industrious. Charismatic? Is pompous or meddler not a trait?
Okay, yeah. Well,
it's a different kind of charismatic.
You are Canadian, so you're not really the right person to ask, I think.
Maybe it passes for charismatic if you're French.
For Greece, creative and philosophical, Pericles. For the Ottoman, I want to say Suleiman, but that he's imperialistic and philosophical. And then Darius I for Persia, financial and organized.
And also, interestingly enough, we saw a leader head for Boudica. I think that one will prove popular. I think Catherine has some competition.
Yeah, forget about Catherine.
Talk to me.
I just wanted to lean forward.
Oh boy.
You and all the rest of the guys playing too.
Yeah.
I think fans will be very surprised, not only about the new content we're adding, but about how much better we're making the game in general. The game will be much more polished. You can't put that as a bullet point on the box, but it's true.
And there's a few new units coming out in BTS as well, and from the IGN article, one we can see in the first picture is a privateer. Yay!
Pillage.
Yeah, there's another new ship, the Ship of the Line. It's basically a version of the frigate for players who prefer something a little stronger at the cost of a little speed. So it's basically a better but a slower unit. I'm not sure if the naval game really needs a lot more new units.
Because first the AI has to learn to play it.
Yeah.
Yeah, slower but stronger, but still better than an ironclad, right?
Yeah. Probably.
Ugh, I'm glad.
That's not hard to beat.
You can walk faster than the ironclad.
And the next new unit is one of my personal favorites, actually. It's the attack sub, which is, quote from IGN, ideally suited for combat against other subs, but can also transport non-combat units pretty much anywhere in the world without being detected.
This is how we sneak our spies in.
Yes.
We don't know the exact stats, of course, but that's a new dimension to submarine warfare.
So you put your great spy in, you take your great spy out. No.
Okay.
A self-destroyer can shoot down enemy aircraft, but this one is also invisible.
Yeah, that's a nice little bonus.
So that's a real key thing. Park it right off the main city and they think, oh, I can just send my bombers in.
Mm-hmm.
No.
And it can also bombard.
Yeah. So that's kind of fun. You're being bombarded, but you have no idea where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm. Oops, what happened to that mine?
There's also a guided missile. It's kind of neat because it can evade interception altogether, although it's not as destructive as nukes.
Mm.
And I guess the tactical nuke, all we knew about is that it's less powerful than a regular nuke.
It only pollutes 7 square inches of weight.
You would also assume from the word tactical that it obviously doesn't have the range of the ICBM.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense here.
Yeah, that would probably be another reason they gave us a missile cruiser.
Exactly, that's where the missile cruiser comes in.
Come on, go up next to it and go, oops, I hit the wrong button. I'm so sorry.
While we're on missiles, we might as well discuss the other air units. And there's only one, I think. It's the airship, which is good at spotting submarines and at fighting naval units. But as IGN says, the real innovation with air combat isn't the new units, but in the way the whole air war has changed. There's an entirely new set of promotions just for air units, and some new rules for interception as well.
Finally, promotions for all my bombers.
Yeah, that sounds pretty interesting. We have learned about the interception, that airplanes can now intercept multiple times per turn, so that should make fighters a little bit more powerful. Definitely think it's a good idea to add promotions for air units, and a bit more depth.
Yeah, we've needed that for a while.
The airship has a strength of 4, as we can glean from a screenshot on IGN.
That doesn't seem like an awful lot.
Well, it's not meant to be an attacker, though.
That's true.
As we can glean from a screenshot on GameSpot or IGN, one of those places. One of those places. 24 hit points for a paratrooper. Can perform paradrops with a range of 5. Tiles costing 160 hammers. The gameplay footage on GameSpot, which as far as I know is the first site to release videos from this expansion pack. In video number 3, you can actually see the animation of the paratroopers dropping in.
Yeah, that looked pretty cool. And I guess we'll be seeing some of those in the World War II scenario, Dale?
There's a few things.
Probably the coolest new unit, I would think. I'm not sure how much it really adds to the game, but it's a nice little feature.
And the mobile Sam, 22 hit points. 2 movement from, again, one of those sites that has lots of screenshots of them. I'm not even trying to keep up anymore.
Too much information.
The mobile artillery, which is pretty neat. A artillery that can move 2 tiles per turn. I guess you don't have the hit points for that. Because that would be interesting.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think I saw that in the screenshot. No, I was looking for it. No, no hit points for that one. Anti-tank, 14 hit points, 120 hammer costs. And the other thing with units, if you have a look in the GameSpot video number 3, when he raises a Russian city after capturing it, he gets the following on-screen prompt. Russian citizens from the city we just raised are taking to the surrounding countryside to form partisan resistance units.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. A nice little return to Shift 2.
There's a further main game interface message where it says, announce to everyone that the Russian city have seen their homes burned. They are rising up against the wicked Dutch invaders.
Yeah, that was a totally random pick of Civ, right, Dan?
Mm-hmm. Actually, not the Civ that the GameSpot player is playing.
Oh, dear.
They're not happy. That's what they're trying to tell
you. Think? Well, I guess this will stop people from raising cities all over the place. At least as much.
You may have to carry around a bit more units to stop the partisans.
Just notice in the CFC chat that it says you can paradrop from the forts, and you can put aircraft in them.
Oh, yes.
They're no longer useless.
Yeah, they've really beefed up the forts a lot. The canals, the air bases, they're a lot of different things now. They can claim resources.
Mm.
So yeah, I think we'll be seeing a few more of those now.
Yeah, they're almost worth building, yeah.
Yes. The days of just building them to decorate your desert is over.
But now what am I going to decorate my desert with?
So what's the big difference between Warlords and Beyond the Sword?
Well, Warlords was all about combat, bloodshed. We brought all the greatest warriors from history into our game. Warlords is like getting punched in the face. Beyond the Sword is much more insidious, much more subtle, much more about finesse.
Also in this first Beyond the Sword feature on IGN, they look at new buildings that we've heard about in passing otherwise. Levy, unlocked once a player researches steam power, grants a production bonus to all river tiles within the city radius.
Yeah, that's a nice little bonus. It's definitely worth building if you can build it.
If you have lots of rivers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if you have one tile, it's probably not really worth it.
Customs House, once you discover the secret of economics and have a harbor in place, you can build this to gain a boost to all foreign trade coming in from overseas.
On Archipelago, that's going to be a pretty powerful building. It's maybe to some extent on continents and some other map types.
I'd be interested to see how that works with the new trade route.
Oh, yes. We haven't actually heard a whole lot more about that.
Well, Dell, you find out what you can about that and report back. Thank you.
Is that an invite to come back to another one?
Also, the industrial park, players who want to gain a few extra engineers can do so by building this. It's an additional sickness generated by this building, but a few extra engineers are usually quite helpful, especially if you're wanting for resources and some.
Yeah, well, it can be helpful, but I guess it depends a bit on the city, because the unhealthiness, yeah, I guess it depends also on how much it is.
But they've also supplied a new building as well, which is the next one to offset the health.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
Yes, public transportation.
Public transportation, yeah.
Ooh, in stereo. And the intelligence agency works to amplify the player's efforts to spy on others, while the security bureau makes it more expensive and more difficult for rival players to perform espionage in that city.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Specifically, on all of these buildings, in the GameSpot preview, it was pointed out on a thread on CFC that if you have a look at the screenshots, you learn quite a bit more. Just in addition to the writing, the Security Bureau gives you +8 great spy points, +50% defense against espionage and helps thwart rival spies, and can turn 2 citizens into spies.
So wait, great spy points, you mean now they're a great person?
Yes, that was also revealed. I guess that brings us onto the topic of espionage.
Segway.
I can build James Bond.
Jane Bond.
Jane Bond for you. It's James Bond for me. Thank you very much.
Espionage will be a big part of the game, and you can tell that because you allocate part of your commerce to espionage, just like you allocate part of your commerce to research and culture. So in order to compete with research and culture, espionage pretty much has to be a central part of the game.
A lot of new details were revealed about espionage. We saw a lot of new graphics, a very cool ninja unit, and indeed James Bond. Kind of funny.
I had to have an excuse to do that.
Again?
Again.
Yeah, so espionage basically works. You collect points. You do that in same way that you collect culture points. Well, the culture you collect in different ways, I guess. But there's basically a espionage tax. You can allocate part of your tax to research, to culture, and now also to espionage. And I think that will make a very interesting strategy. Espionage has a couple of effects. Some of them are passive, seeing that you can see people's demographics. Once you've gathered enough espionage points, you can get visibility in the cities. You can investigate cities. It basically means opening the city screen, I would assume. And you can see what people are researching. But to do that, you have to gather enough points. By default, all the points you gather are distributed evenly over all your opponents, but you can allocate them. If you want to say, I'm going to war with the Dutch, you can say, I want all my espionage to go to the Dutch. And that means, you, of course, they get more points and you can see more stuff from them. And you can also build certain buildings that help with espionage or with anti-espionage, such as castles, courthouses, and jails, and what we just mentioned, security bureau. And we now also have spy specialists. I assume those would also add spy points. And there are ways to collect points. And you have spies that you can build to do missions. And you can get great spies, which are a new kind of great people. We know that they can build Scotland Yard. And they can go to a foreign city. And it gives you a big boost in espionage points for that civ.
I mentioned earlier how I would demonstrate that I am more insane than Dale. I went through all of the screenshots that GameSpot posted, and I pulled out all of the new information I could find, because, as I said, I'm insane.
Not a newsflash.
And further to both espionage and the unique units, the intelligence agency also gives you +8 great spy points, and then +50% great spy points, and it can also turn 2 citizens into a spy. And it has cost 180 hammers and the Security Bureau 220, so It seems, especially for all the benefit that you can get out of it, as Motor was describing, it would be crazy not to take advantage.
Yeah, espionage, it adds really a new layer to the game. Because before it was really you run 90% as 100% science throughout the game. Now you may have to rethink your strategy a bit. Because, of course, if you don't, you A, can't spy on other people, and B, you become more vulnerable to other people spying on you. I think that adds a lot of fun to the game.
All of the additional options your spies have now, steal treasury, new one, a poison water, causing 8 unhappiness for 8 turns, and there are modifiers to this task and with any others, either positive or negative, the distance. Stationary spy and espionage point spending.
There's also change rival civics and religions as well.
I'm going to make you switch to pagan. Yeah, that's it.
Sabotage building, foment unhappiness, perform counter-espionage, where it adds 200% to the cost of espionage missions against you, but not indefinitely, 6 turns from the screenshots. In the CFC chat, Alex indicated that with the Great Spy, you can have him join one of your own cities as a specialist.
Me and Julia hiding in a dark room with no windows.
Like a true programmer.
Yes.
So it talks about in the first IGN article that Beyond the Sword kind of fills out the roster of the original 7 wonders of the world with the vision of the mausoleum of Mausolus and the statue of Zeus. The Christo Redentor, we mentioned this, but it eliminates anarchy, switching between civics and religions immediately. The city it's located in is more likely to generate a great engineer, but I think we learn publicly for the first time that it's available once you have researched radio. And leaders who have the spiritual trait construct it twice as quickly.
One other benefit that we gleaned from a screenshot, because if you're spiritual, you don't really have an interest in building Crystal Redemptor, but you already have that effect.
Gives you something you already did.
Yeah.
So why can you build it twice as quickly if you're spiritual?
But it has one extra effect we learned, and that's that you no longer have to wait 4 turns between changing your civics or your religion. So you can now change at any point. And that's a pretty neat bonus.
2 or 3 times a turn?
Yeah, if you want to. I'm not sure why you'd want to, but...
It costs 1,000 hammers. Also with wonders, the mausoleum. Available after the discovery of calendar. So, I guess if you're Ethiopia, you might not be going for this red one.
Yeah, or Native Americans.
Native Americans, yes. But after the discovery of calendar, it can be constructed twice as fast as with marble. The home city more likely to generate great artists. The IGN article says, quote, its real benefit is the ability to extend the civilization's golden age by 50%, unquote.
It's not a huge wonder. It's not as powerful as some others, maybe, but I think it has its own benefits.
The Shwedagon Paya, home city more likely to generate great profits. Built after the discovery of meditation and aesthetics, can be constructed twice as quickly. Gold. I have to say it's nice to see construction benefit with resources other than strategic resources, but with some luxury resources. That's a nice addition. I approve.
Oh, they can sleep better now.
Yeah. Makes gold even more valuable now.
The statue of Zeus, also aesthetics, and the IGN article says that once you've discovered aesthetics and have built 2 monuments, you can build the statue of Zeus. A screenshot on GameSpot showed 3 monuments, so I'm thinking perhaps that's a typo or don't know if it's an earlier build issue, but in any event, 2 or 3 monuments, they recover a basis that way. Those who go to war against civilization that control the statue will suffer twice as much war weariness as they otherwise might. And it can be constructed twice as quickly with ivory, if you can find it, and the city that houses it is more likely to generate great artists.
Well, that's an interesting effect with the war weariness. I suppose if you got into a really long war, that would actually help, but most early wars are pretty short.
Yeah.
Usually. Does it say when it expired anywhere, or...?
It does not expire.
Oh. Well, then it's very useful in the modern era.
This is definitely one of those wonders you go for if you're playing purely defensive.
Yeah, definitely.
Or if an MP, you know you're playing against other players who are particularly aggressive.
playing as the Native Americans and then building the Great Wall and this wonder. That would be a pretty powerful strategy.
Or it could also help the uber-aggressive player or nation, because obviously the uber-aggressive person's going to be at war with other people quite a lot, and it's going to hurt them even more.
That's true.
You know, I could slow down their production and stuff just at the right moment so they can overtake them, even if it was a close battle.
Is it Apostolic Palestine?
Might as well.
I guess.
You're the boss.
Did you say butt or boss or what they're doing?
They're both applicable.
The Apostolic Palace, unlocked once you research theology, works for any civilization that has a state religion and can only be built in cities with the state religion, opens up a diplomatic victory possibility early on through global elections. But as was said in the CFC chat, Alex, he has said, we have yet to see someone win with the Apostolic Palace through the global elections, but it is possible.
I have seen exactly one win with the Apostolic Palace, so it is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an AI of all things, so... I lost that game.
Where the Apostolic Palace's influence is dependent on the acceptance of its religion throughout the world. Other civilizations that share that religion enjoy some significant production bonuses, but can have diplomatic decisions forced on them. I think it's also worth noting, both with the Apostolic Palace and now with the United Nations, you can defy resolutions. And
yeah, that's interesting.
Finally.
That's been a popular request.
Yep, and only comes with a happiness penalty, not a full diplomatic penalty, too.
Yeah, that's going to make it a bit more painful to defy them.
Mm-hmm. The Apostolic Palace, a world wonder, 268 hammer cost, plus 4 culture, plus 2 great profit points, where it talks about can only be built in cities where the state religion is present, and then it gains some form of diplomatic control over leaders. And this was interesting. And cities that share the religion that the palace was associated with when it was founded. So you can therefore build the palace and then switch to a different religion.
Yeah, I'm not sure why you would want to, but...
Well, if you're the Lone Confucian Seven, Isabella's made the rest of the world Buddhist.
Yeah.
Then it might be handy.
They're probably just going to use the Apostolic Palace against you in that case, so... They're all going to gang up, vote that your city should be moved to other cities or something like that.
And so just like with the United Nations, if you are the owner of the palaces, if you're the owner of the United Nations, you're automatically in the running for leader. And now with the Apostolic Palace, this is interesting. The rival is the leader who has the largest population living in cities that share the palace's religion and acknowledges it as their state religion. Leaders who share the palace's religion become full voting members. A full voting member can have their production bonuses revoked and suffer a happiness penalty if they openly defy a resolution. So the only way to regain full membership is then to vote on a later measure that passes. And it says this same sort of concept of demoted membership also now applies to the UN.
Woohoo!
Yay!
The last key piece that we find is when the Apostolic Palace becomes obsolete, and that's with mass media.
Yeah, as I found out in a very painful way.
There's also on IGN a comment that if someone goes to war with a full voting member, then all the other full members can vote to go to war together against that person.
Got news? Email news@apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, Illuminatus, Snoopy369, or Grand Patrol via Apolton's forums at apolton.net/forums.
The people are the heroes now.
Episode 17 comments from Night Owl and Nugog. Night Owl broke up his comments from episode 17 based on what we talked about, mercantilism, our great general segment, and winning a culture victory. Night Owl cites an external reality when choosing to switch to mercantilism in single player. He says, when AI Civ switched to it, he says, there's no point of being the only Civ wanting foreign trade when everyone else doesn't want it.
That's true, but I can't remember having being in that situation.
But at the same time, he says, mercantilism by itself is quite weak, so I generally run it in combinations with other civics and wonders. His civics, representation, I like representation, I'll agree to that. pacifism, meh, and caste system.
Okay. Those are all things that I rarely use, especially pacifism, because you do want to keep up a reasonable army.
Yes.
Maybe representation sometimes, but I guess the combo of those things might be quite powerful. Could be interesting to play around with.
On Great Generals, Night Owl says, War Academies give plus 25% hammers to military units. Are you guys still playing without the 2.8 Warlords patch? In the patch, War Academies give you a bonus of 50% instead, but they're only available after education, quote-unquote. Whoops.
Which tells you how much I get Great Generals if I couldn't remember that.
Yeah, that's actually particularly bad that I didn't think of it, because that could have helped the presentation of my argument of them over military instructors. Although it being flipped to be a more mid to late game preference as opposed to an early game preference because you need education. But anyway, Nugog says that he almost never attaches Great Generals to units. They tend to go to my one or two military cities. I initially used them to attach to units initially, but then they got killed. So city settlement becomes my favorite use for them. We hear that heartache. And finally, Culture Victory. Night Owl says, I've heard some people start their Culture Victory, switching to 100% Culture Slider, as early as Liberalism, once they get the free speech civic with the plus 100% Culture in all cities. Personally, I beeline to Democracy after Liberalism for universal suffrage, civics to Gold Rush temples and cathedrals.
Well, that's one way to do it. I still keep checking the whole game, but towards the modern age, I reduce the science percent maybe to 50% or something like that, but I still like getting new decks.
I wouldn't switch to the Free Speech Civic as soon as I got it, unless I was really suffering culturally. But I switched to Universal Suffrage to rush temples and cathedrals, assumes you have the goal to do that. Yeah, Night Owl, though, beelining to communism for the Kremlin wonder.
Mm-hmm.
So my gold rushing is cheaper, but only if my gross national product is very high compared to other civs. The Kremlin? No. So I suppose if you're bored and it's not obsolete yet, you could build the Kremlin.
Something a little more important to build.
I don't think so. I think 6 to 7 religions per city is a bit overboard for a culture victory. Saying imagine how many hammers you've lost by producing missionaries and find out they failed to spread that particular religion in that city, because generally the chances of spreading the 6th and 7th religion in a city is very low.
It doesn't usually take more than 3 or 4 in my experience.
Saying the minimum number of religions for a culture victory, he's saying, is 3, 4 is optimal, and anything over 5 per city, and you start getting diminishing returns. I think that's, and again, that's kind of a generalization.
I disagree with that. The more, the better.
Wow.
It's true. Yeah, we got mail.
And it wasn't spam.
That was the other surprise.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-659. 301-637-POLY.
And for Europe, 44-020-7871-7659. 44-020-7871-POLY.
Or you can Skype us at the Polycast.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on the show, including how to write in and how to subscribe to the RSS feed, log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net.
Type more quietly.
Yeah,
man.
Seriously.
How does that?
That's mean? What my freaking keyboard makes, damn it.
What else do we still have to discuss?
I was thinking about that, actually.
I don't know how long we want to keep this up.
I'm going to have to go soon.
We can almost make 2 episodes out of this. Dale will go, and then Keegan will join us. Next. Next victim.
Tag team.
Next sucker.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to episode 18 of Polycast, the official podcast of a Polton Civilization site. I've been joined by our guest co-host, Dale.
See you guys.
Thank you for all the exclusive details. You may now go.
Yes, sir.
I've also been joined by Mackie.
Hi. Hi. Something. You got me up too early, man.
Blame Dale. It's all his fault.
It's not his. It's your fault. Everything's your fault.
I know. It makes things easier to accept that way.
Well, think yourself lucky. It's Sunday here.
Are you in the future? Cool. And Walter Schneider, known as Locutus on the forums.
Bye.
Did anybody notice how many co-hosts have birthdays in June? It's a little scary.
They do.
How very observant of you, Walter. Are you sure the server is still online? Maybe you better check that.
I could check for you.
Record date June 23rd, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization 4 and its Warlords expansion pack. Beyond the Podcast Lips copyright for Axis Games. Copyright 2007, a Poulton Civilization site at apoulton.net.